The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and Happy New Year to you all. Maybe after the holiday season, we're all feeling just a little bit of shame, but that's also the title of the latest provocative work by artist Steve McQueen, featuring an already award-winning performance by Michael Fassbender as a sex addict in New York. I'll be discussing their hunger for cinema and sex with both McQueen and Fassbender together again. And with the financial crisis ever deepening, a timely release is Margin Call from writer-director J.C. Shandor, unravelling the horror of a banking meltdown and gathering together a stellar cast including Kevin Spacey, Demi Moore and Stanley Tucci. J.C. Shandor himself joins us to discuss the risky terror of the numbers game. And Guardian critic Zan Brooks will be along as we review Meryl Streep as Mrs. T in The Iron Lady, Naomi Watts and Samuel L. Jackson in Mother and Child, and Sean William Scott pucking his heart out in the hockey comedy Goon. It's the best start to the new year. It's Film Weekly. The combination of artist and director Steve McQueen and actor Michael Fassbender is an electric one. Their first creative meeting gave rise to Hunger in 2008, the visually stunning and visceral tale of the imprisoned Irish Republican Bobby Sands, played by an emaciated Fassbender, and his fatal hunger strike for political status in the infamous Mays prison in 1981. With the forthcoming Shame, Fassbender and McQueen shift their focus from politics to addiction.
You nailed it today. I want you to know, you nailed it. You're the man. Your pitch, amazing, amazing. Listen, we're playing a game here. Close your eyes again.
You win.
Bravo.
All right, you. Hey, come on. Come on. Close your eyes.
Blue.
That's,
you're just making that up.
Good. She's just, he's just picking good. Colors randomly.
You can have this shot.
You know what? Excuse me. You need another shot, please?
What do you girls do for fun?
Fun?
Fassbender plays the successful, handsome New Yorker Brandon, whose shiny life is finely tuned around his sexual compulsions. Until, that is, his sister Sissy, played by Carey Mulligan, arrives for an extended stay, and suddenly Brandon's secret world starts to unravel. When I met up with Steve McQueen and Michael Fassbender here in London, I started out by asking Michael what his initial reaction was to this new script, written this time by McQueen and Abby Morgan.
The first thing that struck me, I was like, wow, this is a really beautifully written script. It's very eloquent and it's very sort of insightful and respectful. And I cared about the characters, you know, and I cared about Brandon. It was somebody that I liked immediately. Through his struggle, I got to like him, you know, and then it's, you know, then it's a healthy dose of fear. And it's like, wow, I hope I can sort of, you know, live and breathe and sort of occupy this guy's shoes. And then,
does it help to like the character you play? I mean, you know, on the surface, he's not the most likable kind of guy. I mean, yes, he's attractive in many ways to many people, but likable is an interesting kind of term for him. Does it help for you? I guess you have to understand him as playing. And does it help when you like him?
I suppose it does. I mean, it's like, to a certain degree, I think I like all the characters that I play. It's almost like you're fighting in their corner, you know? So you sort of stand up for them and you sort of, you try and get inside their head and figure out their motivations and figure out exactly what it is that sort of they're trying to negotiate, you know? Because everybody is trying to sort of, you know, negotiate their way through the story and life. Yeah. And I think the main thing that one should never do, and I think that goes for the same as for a filmmaker, is judge. And you know, we just try and sort of understand why does that behavior occur, and why does that relationship occur with himself? Where does it come from? What does he want? How does he make this person feel? How do they make him feel? And you try and ask questions, because it's about all of us, you know. It's not about going, oh, look at Brandon, you know, he's a freak. It's like, no, Brandon is part of all of us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we're all responsible for each other. So how do we deal with it?
Yeah. There's an interesting sort of method at work when watching the film, in that it's, you know, in the modern world where everyone's fast cutting, this is a film that really doesn't have that many scenes. You know, I'm watching it and thinking, this is a long scene. This is 6 minutes, 7 minutes. There's quite a lot of one-take stuff that's still in here. Obviously, famously, you did it in the middle of Hunger for 12 minutes. But you kind of carried that that method forward here as well? Is there a kind of way that you collaborate together to kind of say, well, we're just going to let you go here, or is it very strictly choreographed to that length?
I think it's a bit of both, really. I think, you know, actors come in, we rehearse, they move in a space how they think they should move in a space, and I sort of move them, I think, where I think they should be as such. But at the same time, there's that freedom. You have to have that freedom, but also you have to have the sort of the interesting cinematography. So there's got to be interesting. The two things have to combine: the freedom of the actor, and in some ways, the sort of how we portray the images of what they're doing on screen. And it's just an interesting combination. I think Kerry was very liberated actually by the whole experience, because usually she was so much. With film, she's often done it with her marks and where her marks were. And all of a sudden, those marks had disappeared for her. So there was an element of freedom, I think, which came out in her performance. I think she performed better than I thought she would have done, I'll be honest. Mm-hmm. And I think that was an element of that in it. So it's a collaboration within the actors and the camera. Yeah. And directing, because you've got to allow the actor to be free in order to produce.
The ideal scenario is to be relaxed in a scene as much as you can, to be sort of, responsive and to be awake to what's going on and little things that are happening. And, you know, you respond to that, might be in the script or whatever. But then there's an element as well where you've got to keep things tight. You know, otherwise it starts to sort of become like mush and put, you know, and it doesn't have you have to retain the focus or the framework that you're working within. So, you know, you're searching for rhythms, you're trying to sort of be awake and aware of the other actor and what they're doing and the sort of, you know, and the actors in the scene around you, whatever, you're trying to sort of be awake to that. But you also have to be in tune, and you know, you have to find the rhythms, and sometimes the rhythms come quicker than other times. But it's all about the rhythm and keeping relaxed, but also... Keeping very focused.
Yeah. I mean, what about the scenes in the flat as well, where you walk in and out of shot, in and out? I mean, I love scenes like that where people disappear off and then go into the doors and then they come back again, wandering around. Is that a deliberate kind of choice, or is that kind of one that's informed by the fact the flat is small? Or
I think both. I think when we wrote it, we didn't have an apartment, but when we got to the apartment, it's like great. I mean, one person, I think one of the sparks is, "So, Steve, should we put the fridge door the other way around? So when he opens it, he's not blocked." I said, no, leave it exactly how it is. Sometimes those limitations, in fact, those limitations are freedom in a way, because it just, there's a rhythm, there's a rhyme to it, and therefore it tells you where to put the camera. It tells you how, you know, one leaves a bedroom and goes to the kitchen sink and comes back into to the bathroom. It's, for me, it's like Tai Chi. It kind of informs you how to make the film.
I mean, I love those scenes in this flat. Especially the one you wander around, flopping around, like, very relaxed. You must have been for that one, I must say. Comes back naked. Was that written in? Was that in the script? He comes back naked? Whose decision was
we
that?
We did it in various costumes. Once I was wearing a gorilla outfit.
Came back in a zebra. Jump cuts.
What about the running scene, which... I think it's a remarkable kind of New York shot. Do you know what I mean? One of the classic New York shots. And I think running on screen is really difficult to do. I've seen some actors are like really rubbish at running. Even
that's
cool.
Everyone kept saying to me, it's like actors can't run. And why is it that in most scenes actors run really badly?
Because they act running. They don't run. They act running. There's a difference. Someone said you had really good form running.
Well, yeah.
Hey.
Did you practice that? Because how long is it, that shot? About four minutes, 2 weeks?
I think it's about 3 minutes, the shot. Yeah. I think four takes. It's about 3 minutes, the shot in length. And it was just one of those things where I just thought, okay, well, what does Brandon do to get away? I mean, it's ritual. He, you know, and New Yorkers are running and jogging and so forth. And of course, you know, he listens to Bach, the Goldberg variations. I mean, in his apartment, he has this tactile relationship with music, which obviously is a different thing now. It's up in the cloud somewhere, obviously. We don't have that tactility. And I think for Brandon, it was something to hold on to, Bach. So with the running and what was going on upstairs in his apartment with David and Sissy, he needed something to hold on to and to get away from. Yeah. And that was it.
It's a great scene. Were you knackered at the end of it? Or you kind of, you know?
It wasn't too bad. I mean, I used to run when I was, you know, obviously much younger, but I used to do, you know, but I was like 100, 200 meters. That was my sort of, you know, distance.
Because Bobby Sands was cross country.
Yeah, I know. Something about sort of running that you've got going on there, Stu. you know, no, it's you know, I could sort of uphold it. You know, by the fourth one, I suppose I was relatively sort of feeling it, but no, it was all right.
Yeah, must have been a good feeling to run. I mean, through New York Street like that, and end up at the Madison Square Garden, like straight right in front of that legendary venue.
I mean, and a nice little story about that. You see at the end of the shot, there's the crossing, the green hand and the red man saying stop. It's broken. What happened actually? There was a sort of I think a hot dog lorry or whatever, a little truck that we wanted it, when it moved, and what happened? And we moved it knocked down the sort of the sign. So it was great. This is fantastic. So it's one of those sort of again happy accidents.
Isn't there a happy accident because you shot the Standard Hotel as well? Some of the scenes. Did you not attract a crowd while you were standing there?
Well, that's
naked?
Called a happy ending.
No, I tell you what about that. That is a strange. There was no paparazzi. There was no crowd. Really, there was. We checked out. No one. But all of a sudden, these photographs appear in a New York Post and stuff. It's kind of crazy. How that happened, I don't know. Obviously, it was an inside job.
It's a beautiful hotel to have. To look out of at the windows.
Interesting views.
What were you thinking? I mean, I know you're in the zone when you're acting, but there must have been time where you were just like standing there waiting for them to get the light right and stuff, and you must have been going, when it was looking at the view.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, you're like, so what are you going to do for the summer holidays? You know, I mean, you just sort of, it is what it is. It is what it is. You got to go back. It is what it is.
But you must be thinking, New York, you know, if I can make it here, make it anywhere. King of the Hill, top of the heap. There you are, standing like 14 stories up, start bullet naked. Yeah.
New York!
It's that moment where you turn to the camera and go, hey, Ma.
Top of the world.
I made it.
Well, it is a brilliant film. I absolutely was flabbergasted by it, stunned by it. Brilliant. I mean, just I kind of say I enjoyed it, but that seems to be that's the right emotion. But it's really what I had.
It's an emotion. I think what it is, it's like the blues. It hurts so good. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what it is. I mean, for me, it's almost like Charlie Rampling's face. It's so beautiful. It's so sad. Buster Keaton's face. You know, there are things which actually kind of touch you in different ways.
Yeah. And your face at the end, yeah, I mean, that stays with me, as well as your bum as well. about all of you, Michael, it stays with me.
The strange thing about that shot, I mean, of Michael, sort of, that was the last shot of the film. That was the last shot that we shot of the film. And that was sort of
the orgy scene.
Yeah, and that was quite amazing because when I saw it it gave me goose pimples because it was just one of those things where it felt like the end in a way. It was kind of exhausting. We shot the movie in 25 days, which apparently is fast. I had no idea that was fast. So it was just one of those wonderful things that we tied the film up with, which was just amazing. So I'm just very pleased.
One of the great shots of the year, of which there are many in the film. Congratulations, guys. Michael, Steve, thanks for coming on the show again.
Thank you very much.
And Shame is on release here in the UK from Friday the 13th of January. Now, from sex addict to film addict. That's about the nicest thing I could say to you. We'll call you back to the
both,
new year.
Jason, you can be
you
both.
You can be both. And happy new year to you.
Thank you very much.
Nice Christmas, new year and all that.
Very nice indeed.
Good. You were, of course, busy compiling your top threes and top tens for us here at Film Weekly, as we know.
I was. I'm absolutely exhausted from it. And we're already into January.
I know. Some very good films already. This is the thick season where they come thick and fast. And it's always good. Those ones that are kind of being nominated, you think, oh, well, that's good. And then there's always those few that kind of, obviously, the studio thought they might be nominated, but no one's really paying them much attention.
Yeah, it's a bit full on. It's the empty restaurant syndrome, isn't it? They're opening with a great fanfare, but nobody's going to go.
Nobody's going to go. I'm sorry. And Mildred Pierce, she knew what that felt like when she opened up her chicken joint. Dan, this week, however, we do have a film that I think certainly will be troubling many awards academies and awards bodies, if not for the film itself, then certainly for the performance of a famous Meryl Streep playing Lady Thatcher.
Gentleman knows very well that we had no choice but to close the school. Because his union paymasters have called a strike deliberately to cripple our economy. Teachers cannot teach when there is no heating, no lighting in their classrooms. And I ask the Right Honourable Gentleman, whose fault is that?
Yours! Yours!
The film is, of course, The Iron Lady, written by Abby Morgan, directed by Phyllis Deloitte, and starring Meryl Streep. Is there anyone else in here other than Meryl Streep? Is it just a Meryl Streep tour de force performance?
It's very much The Iron Lady as The Iron Lady as The Iron Lady. There are other people around, but they're very much out on the sidelines. You've got Jim Broadbent as lovable Dennis, who we all remember with great affection, don't we, old Dennis? And so you've got Jim Broadbent playing him. You've got Olivia Colman as Carol.
Carol Thatcher.
You've got Richard E. Grant very briefly as Michael Heseltine.
Yeah. John Sessions as Ted Heath.
John Sessions, yeah.
Not a very good one from John Sessions this one, but he didn't get much to work with.
Not really, but that's Ted Heath for you. Yeah, he didn't really give much
Mike
to
Yarwood
work with.
Mike Yarwood always did him all right.
Yeah.
The shoulders.
Yeah, 30-odd years ago though, Jess.
You've got Jeffrey Howe.
You have got Jeffrey Howe, and you've got sort of off-screen role for little Mark Thatcher, who we see sort of cavorting on a beach or swinging on a swing. And again, it fosters the impression that Mark's an adorable little character.
Well, she seemed to like him very much.
She liked him. I'm not sure I do.
I always remember him being getting smacked by her as mum on Spitting Image, and she just banged him on the desk like a kind of mascot.
If only that had really happened.
Yeah, well, the film, however, is it a good... Are we watching it for a movie, or are we watching it for a legendary performance by Meryl Streep, who does Thatcher as demented pensioner, as now talking to Dennis over the breakfast table, going out for a pint of milk and finding the world much changed. Then we flash back to her as a young Thatcher, played by Alexandra Roach, an actress I've never seen before.
No, but she's perfectly good.
I thought she was very good.
Yep.
And then you see Thatcher in her early years as the Long Walk to Finchley, and then onwards as she becomes leader of the Tory party and then prime minister throughout the Falklands, done in a rock and roll years kind of style. Yeah. We've got the Falklands and the poll tax riots and much in between. Do we grow with Streep? Because it's a biopic, but not done in the traditional linear fashion.
Well, I suppose what is seen as controversial, the decision to bookend it and basically thread it with scenes of her now in her dotage,
it's basically
on the verge of dementia,
looking a bit
flashing back.
Yeah.
Some people say that's tasteless. I think it actually wins sympathy for her. I mean, it's hard to take against somebody even as controversial as Thatcher when you're seeing her, in frail, lonely old age.
Yeah.
Aside from that, I think it's very much a greatest hits package. It's really printing the legend, isn't it? It's the one woman show. It's Thatcher as she, I think, would have liked to have been seen, and to be fair, is seen and continues to be seen by many, many people as this powerful, colourful, charismatic figure storming the barricades of sexism and class, and basically shaking things up and getting Britain, into the 21st century a little ahead of schedule. Having said that, though, the descent is very much noises off, isn't it?
You mean the poll tax riots itself?
Well, everything that we associate with Thatcherism, the deregulation of the financial sector, the mass privatisation of state-run companies, rising unemployment, rising inequality, all of that is very much notable by its absence. And what you have a little bit of archive footage of the poll tax riots, and you have a scene where a bunch of protesters bang on the window of her car and say that she's a monster. But when you have these people coming in from nowhere, totally without context, you're obviously, as a filmgoer, your identification is with the nice woman in the car, and you're thinking, who are these horrible people calling her a monster? What are they on about?
Well, those oiks
that
are part of the proles.
So it's very much within the goldfish bowl.
You see miners getting beaten by the state, by policemen. And,
again, but why are they?
But it's seen very much as a kind of extension of her iron rule, is it not? It's seen as a kind of part of her kind of obstinacy, that she is very much this person that's kind of, ordering Britain into war when they can't afford it, and then ordering the non-profitable mines to be shut. And it's not that feeling for the working man.
Yeah,
is
I'm
not
there asking.
In the film.
You're right, and I'm not asking for this deeply detailed, nuanced analysis of Thatcherism and its consequences, because that would be inappropriate for a film starring Meryl Streep. But you do want some glimmer of the human cost of this, some insight into how people are living who aren't part of Thatcher's inner circle, I think. Maybe that's because we've grown up under Thatcherism. We know all about this. And so to not have it in there seems like an abdication of responsibility.
It does. I think maybe you just have to go and watch This Is England or something else.
Yeah, maybe it's just not that film.
I think it isn't that film. I knew this before. I'd seen the film from your review because you saw it early. And I think that I'd been prepared in a way that it wasn't in there. and it, which made me relaxed actually very much and enjoy the performance of a film which I think is very much about a woman coming to terms with what her legacy and what she's done and her now impotency in a way.
All that's there.
And it is all that. And I just thought Meryl Streep was
It is a terrific performance.
I just thought, I mean, everyone, I don't give her the Oscar now, but I mean, you know, Helen Mirren did The Queen and we gave her the Oscar for that. And that was, but this sort of knocks The Queen into a...
it's an astonishing... You know, the one problem that I had with it is that I thought maybe it's no more than a bit of mimicry. But as a bit of mimicry, it is brilliant.
Yeah.
And maybe Thatcher wasn't much more than that anyway. With Thatcher, what you saw was what you got.
There wasn't much depth.
There wasn't much nuance to her, certainly in the public figure of Thatcher. And who knows what was behind all that. Maybe she didn't. Maybe there was nothing behind it. And so because of that, Streep captures it superbly.
So I thought Streep was outstanding. I thought she never put a foot wrong. I thought the accent never wavered. I never thought for a minute. I even forgot. After about 5 minutes, I forgot. And I went in there looking for a Meryl Streep award.
Of course, yeah.
I forgot it was Meryl Streep. Not only was it not Lady Thatcher, it was a real person in there. I think it's maybe one of the finest performances I've ever seen.
Really,
I could not
Jason?
Believe what
wow.
she was doing. I know. It's a lot. I mean, I thought the film was rather good too. But I did think that she was extraordinary.
I'm bitching and moaning about the film, but it's
you're
perfectly
not the only one. I mean,
it's perfectly entertaining.
It's a
professionally put together piece of work. I completely went with it.
But it's more than that, though, isn't it?
Because it's not more than that.
But it's a biopic that does kind of interesting things with the biography, doesn't it?
Well, interesting things in terms of, you know, rewriting history and airbrushing things. That's interesting.
Well, that's what biopics can do.
Yeah. I was completely entertained by it and yet came out with a whole hornet's nest of swarming issues with it.
Clearly. Are they your issues or the film's issues?
They're my issues, and I'm prepared to own them as my issues. But with a figure like Thatcher, everybody is going to, you know, bring their own perceptions to the table.
I thought we'd see a spitting image bit. I thought we'd see how she was perceived at the time in popular culture.
Yeah.
Was this a film for us as Thatcher babies, or was this a film for American audiences?
Well, this is the interesting thing. You know, another interesting thing. There's so many interesting things about this film. I've heard people saying, oh, it'll play well in England because they all know who Thatcher is, but it's not going to play well in the States. Of course it is. Of course it is. They adored her over there. Their relationship with her was a lot less complicated. You know, this is maybe a terrible cultural stereotype, but I think if you asked Americans who the current Prime Minister is now, 50% of them wouldn't know.
No.
Whereas with Thatcher, I would say a good 80, 90%
would. With Blair, they kind of knew Blair as well, I think.
But that was because of Iraq.
The one US biopic that disappointed me terribly was, of course, Oliver Stone's Bush, which was, you know, we knew George Bush pretty well, I think, and we never got to anywhere near him through
Not
Oliver Stone's biopic. This is a better film than that, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. And I'm very reluctant to.
But I'm not saying that Thatcher is
as
a better
film,
person.
It's lightweight and yet entirely serviceable and diverting. I'm not sure it's overly informative.
Mm. See, I found it moving, but could you not possibly find the frailties and the weaknesses of Thatcher moving? Because
no,
you
there's
hate
too
her
many
so much.
Scars in the past, I think.
Yeah. I would be the same about Hitler. I could not sympathise in any way
yeah,
with Hitler. You obviously loved
not.
Him.
Let's move on before you get me onto Hitler.
And that's The Iron Lady, which I think is a really fascinating piece of work. And this is one of the most fascinating discussions we've had about a film, because we're also talking about the lady herself.
You cannot separate it. You can't do that surgical thing where you remove her from her context and from history and just say, it's just a woman, let's look at this woman's life.
Yeah.
You can't do it.
That's The Iron Lady. Let's move on to Mother and Child, a film which is executive produced by Alexandro González Iñárritu, which might tell you a couple of things, that there is a fractured narrative, many storylines spinning, and a vast cast, including Naomi Watts, here being interviewed for a job by Samuel L. Jackson.
So, in your estimation, what are your professional strengths?
Well, I don't believe in improvisation. I prepare my cases rigorously. I'm on top of clients. I handle them well. I protect them from themselves. I prefer to work on a project by myself, but I can work just as well in a team if necessary. I work equally well with men or women, but I prefer to report to a man.
Why is that?
Many women find me threatening. Would I be reporting to you?
Yes.
Now, I looked at the cast list for this, and everyone in there I like. Annette Bening and Naomi Watts and Samuel L. Jackson. You know, you think, well...
Jimmy Smits.
Haven't seen him for a while.
Yeah, since The West Wing.
Yeah. L.A. Law, we're in kind of that territory here because Naomi Watts is a kind of high-class lawyer. Everyone here has problems with their mother. Everyone here has problems having children with their marriages. There are adopted people. I don't want to spoil anything all over the place, but does it all come together in a kind of Innery 2 kind of way?
Well, we can't say that, can we?
It might
We're
do.
Just going to spoil the whole suspense.
Oh, I forgot Kerry Washington. Kerry Washington. Also looking to adopt a child.
She's looking to adopt because she can't have kids. Yes, the vagaries of fate are going to tie all these loose ends rather neatly together at the end. You've got Annette Bening as Karen, who's a physiotherapist who is living with her elderly mother. Now, she gave up her child for adoption when she was 14. Then you've got Naomi Watts as the slightly uptight, brittle, needy lawyer. And you have Samuel L. Jackson as her boss, who she has an affair with. And you have this sort of swarming cast of damaged souls.
Yeah.
And it's a, I guess, is it an emotional growing story? Are there life lessons here?
I think there are. I mean, it's all done in the most kind of Latin American way. It's directed by Rodrigo Garcia, who is the son of Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of magic kind of realism in there as well. There's a bit of realism as well. It's a bit soapy in that kind of
it's
Mexican
very soapy.
Way.
It's slightly TV soap.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It could be a telenovela.
Yeah.
And yet, Annette Bening is very good. Who this was supposed to be her big Oscar opportunity, and they parked this film. They kind of buried it a bit because
it was
kids
made,
were
like,
right,
was it made like 3 years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, and then the Kids Are All Right came out, and they thought, oh, let's get Annette Bening in another film about people trying to look for their correct parents. She's better in that one than she is in this. She is quite good in this.
She is good in this. And it's like Memories of American Beauty sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's a suburban sort of movie.
Yeah.
Naomi Watts.
I like Naomi Watts.
Yeah, she's very good in this. Very needy. Quite a difficult character, probably the most difficult to fathom in all this.
Yes, and also the most sort of unresolved, that they don't quite know what to do with her
and
after
we don't
a certain
know
point.
Who she is, really.
Yeah.
The film, ultimately, I mean, as we say, we mentioned sort of...
Ultimately, I think it's kind of junky.
Yeah. Zan, did you see Goon?
I didn't see Goon.
Should I tell you about Goon?
Tell me about Goon.
Because I saw
Goon. You're right back on the horse, aren't you?
If there's a film out there, I want to see it. You know what I mean?
Well, then tell me about Goon.
Goon stars Sean William Scott as a bit of a doofus. He's cornered the market in... Doofy. Since Dude, Where's My Car and American Pie. And he's got really good at it. I mean, I used to hate him because he was a terrible actor. But he's actually now really good at playing the sort of doofus. And he plays Doug the Thug Glatt here, a Jewish ice hockey player who is hired mainly because he's just very good at fighting people.
Yeah.
This isn't about ice hockey at all. It's about fist fights. So they get their gloves off.
I thought ice hockey was basically about fist fights.
Well, I believe that's what it is. I mean, we think back to Paul Newman in Slapshot and all of those. It's got a kind of cinematic history, ice hockey, and I rather like it, especially when you've got kind of a classy actor like Liev Schreiber, who here plays Ross the Boss, and he is kind of the inspiration for Doug the Thug.
Everybody loves the soldiers until they come home and stop fighting. You understand what I'm saying?
I don't know, no.
Kid, you got this thing. The stuff, you got it, like me. But like me, that's all you got. And like me, you're no good to anyone doing anything else. All I'm saying is don't go trying to be a hockey player. You get your heart ripped out.
But I am a hockey player, sir.
You're a goon.
That plays hockey. Like you.
I don't play much hockey.
You're a hockey player, sir.
You know they just want you to bleed, right?
Liev Schreiber, it all comes together because he's, of course, married to Naomi Watts in real life.
Wow.
There you go.
This Hollywood, it's just like...
It's one big...
It's like a little Welsh village in the 19th century, isn't it?
It is. It's closed by Thatcher, if we want to really round things off. This is really amiable and silly and violent. It's got Jay Baruchel in it, who I don't really know who he is. He's kind of a cult figure. It's from the producers of Superbad and Pineapple Express. It doesn't quite have the kind of cultish appeal or naivety of those two films, which I
find
quite appealing.
With those sort of hilarious names, it does remind me a little bit of Whippet, which I remember you liking.
I did like Whippet a lot, of course, yes.
Is it a bit like Whippet?
It is a bit, but Whippet was a sort of feminist kind of track. This really is not feminist doesn't get a look in here, really. This is the people who really like watching ice hockey players on YouTube can smash each other to bits. It's based, apparently, even more bizarrely, on a real person called Doug Smith, who wrote a book about his journeyman life. And I suppose it's the Vinnie Joneses of football, or the Ron Chopper Harris's, if you hark back. suppose Joey Barton's about the closest we get in these effete metrosexual days. But these are about where men were men, and they play for the Halifax Highlanders in Nova Scotia, No Hope Towns, lower leagues. And there's something really sort of sad about them. It's kind of money ball, but like gone on kind of PCP or something.
Yeah.
Not that I know what that would be like. But this is what I should imagine it would be a little bit like. I really enjoyed it. Hooch, Moneyball on Hooch is Goon. Zan, lovely to have you back.
Thank you.
Lovely to have you in cinemas again, and lovely to be back in the studio. But we do have one more task to perform this week. Over the Christmas break, we had our greatest hit show, if you like, our countdown of our top 10. We were asking our listeners to email, to Twitter in with their top threes of the year. And loads of you did. And I'm very, very grateful to you. We enjoyed replying to some of you. Couldn't get back to you all, of course, but they've all been logged. We have them all in front of us. We've thrown up the entrance like so much confetti, and three winners have come down. They will be winning, of course, a year's membership to the Picture House Cinemas. Now, there are many of those scattered around the country. You can join you join them all, I think, and you get into whichever one they're showing. So probably some of these films that we are about to reveal, they were showing at Picture Houses. So congratulations to my first one, Zan. I've got someone who tweeted in under the name of Sue Ya, who is Sue Murphy. She says, my top three, we need to talk about Kevin, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and Melancholia. Three choices.
Okay, I'm going for P. Plastic Helmet.
Oh, yeah.
Whose top three is Dreams of a Life, which I seem to remember being in your
top
10. Animal Kingdom, which I think was in your top 10 as
Excellent
well.
Excellent film.
And Ned's, which was a very good film.
Oh, Scottish.
Although both of us cruelly snubbed it. So that's P. Plastic Helmet.
Well done to him. Membership of Picture House on its way to you. And finally, Anna Pratt, Anna P2, who's tweeted in Drive, Rise of the Planet Apes, and Poetry by Lee Chang-dong.
Oh, Poetry,
which is an excellent film with a fantastic performance from the lead actress, whose name I forget, a Korean film that was in Cannes 2010, but was released here 2011 and is nominated in the Critics Circle Best Foreign Films. It's a beautiful film. It's one I actually caught up with over Christmas. Really enjoyed that. She says, I have my fingers and toes cross would be ace to win. Well, you know what? You have. Well done, Anna Pratt. You are now a member of the Picture House near you. Zan, thank you for choosing there. Thank you for coming back into the studio, and for all of your reviews and much, much more. Go to the best film site on the web, guardian.co.uk/film. Now, the elite of the global banking sector are perhaps currently cast as the world's villains, vilified for their role in the credit crunch that broke in 2008 and under which the global economy still struggles. How and why the banking system crunched to a halt is at the centre of debut director J.C. Shandor's rat-a-tat drama Margin Call, and I'm delighted that he can join me in the Film Weekly studio now to discuss it further. Welcome to Film Weekly, J.C.
Well, thank you very much
for having me. Do I call you J.C.? Is that the correct thing to
do? You do indeed. Okay. J period, C period.
Okay. J.C. Shandor, welcome, as I say, to Film Weekly, and congratulations on your film Margin Call. We had one of your actors, Paul Bettany, in this very room not that long ago, talking about how he enjoyed the experience of working on this tiny American movie, he said, called Margin Call, that was just about the acting, getting into it. He really had loved the experience, and he turned his back on Hollywood as a result, although not enough to not do the voice of the butler in the next Iron Man movie, I noticed.
I think he's got kids to put through college.
Exactly. So. he's a key figure in your film, which is a great ensemble cast. Kevin Spacey, Demi Moore, Zachary Quinto. It's a really kind of strong ensemble. It reminded me, if I might say, of David Mamet, maybe because of the presence of Kevin Spacey, who was so strong in causing Glengarry Glen Ross, but the language, the kind of rat-a-tat of it. It was also, to me, the first time I'd really seen dramatized the problems of the world. I've seen a lot of documentaries about the financial crisis in Inside Job, etc. But this made it human. This dramatized it for me. Was that the intention? Because you wrote and directed it as well. So what's your journey with this film? Did you lose a lot of money?
I did not, but I got wrapped up in trying to get rich with a real estate investment, like a lot of people did. So I had sort of a very interesting journey with a bank. And my father had worked in this world, not as a direct trader like anyone in the film, but had worked for an investment bank for Almost 40 years.
Oh, right. Because you seem to understand it, but not to the point of arcaneness where I don't understand it.
Exactly.
I mean, as an outsider, I've got no idea what happened. That's why we need documentaries to explain to us what on earth happened to us. But your film
We absolutely never tried to have this be some kind of definitive statement on what happened. What I found most interesting was, how did we get here? Well, one of the most important elements of how I think we got here is not literally the nuts and bolts of it, but is obviously the human side of this story. How do people kind of live in denial of what is so blatantly in front of them, which is that we, you know, completely overexposed ourselves to, you know, in all these different, you know, categories, and over-leveraged ourselves.
A few people in tall buildings in New York did, and in London, I didn't overexpose
myself. Oh, you didn't?
Well, good. I wish I could have overexposed myself.
Well, and the amazing thing in the United States is that because it seeped into our housing, you know, industry, that got a huge percentage of the population
wrapped up in it.
And people started to feel wealthier than they actually were. It was sort of made up wealth. And so what I found interesting was not that everyone at every base level was as responsible as the people in this film, but the sort of core denial of the facts. Where these were supposed to be the smartest people in the room.
The whole shooting match is sparked by the firing of Stanley Tucci, who's a long-standing servant of this company. He gets kind of brutally fired and let go in a kind of really kind of, you know, efficient kind of firing. I suppose it harked back a little bit to that George Clooney movie, Up
exactly,
in the Air.
Up in the Air. Which this was written before I saw that.
Okay, but it was a strong scene, and he's fired by two women as well. Nothing more emasculating than that. All of that was contained in that scene. But we come back to that character. To Stanley Tucci, he's not in the film that much, but he haunts it.
Yeah. No, the one of the real cores, the real foundation to kind of going back to what I was saying about, you know, how we got into this mess, you know, Penn Badgley's character, who is constantly the youngest guy, Seth, who is constantly asking what everybody makes, is really closely tied into how these people are fired. And the motivation for hiring, firing, why you stay, the compensation packages, how those compensation packages are doled out, the science behind that, and it's not an art. You know, these companies, these are bankers after all. They don't just dole out millions of dollars for the fun of it. So, you know, those practices and how they, you know, in a certain extent, if you were there pumping the brakes or telling people to pump the brakes when the company did not want that to be happening, like Stanley's character, you were sort of paraded in front of the rest of the workforce and sent packing. Mm. And your compensation package was directly related to that. So, you know, once you got in the door of one of these banks, it's very, very hard. Human nature lays it very, very hard to walk away.
They'll chew you up and spit you out. They're revolving doors, aren't they?
And if you stay and you continue to survive, you start to feel that there must be something about you that actually does know what's going on. And I think that led to this sort of false sense of confidence. You know, one of the things I love about the film is that, you know, this one piece, it's very simple, one piece of information goes up the chain of command. But the higher you get, there aren't answers. And in fact, there's sort of more questions in sort of a humorous way. But, you know, everyone kind of expects the person above them to be the person that has the answer. And, you know, obviously when you do that too many steps up the ladder, no one has the answer.
You're right, because you've created a room. You've got the 23-year-old Seth, and then you've got Zachary, who's 28. Then you've got their boss, who is Paul Bettany. Then you've got his boss, who's Kevin Spacey. Then you've got another boss who is young. It's interesting that kind of, and then it goes all the way up to Jeremy Irons, who's the kind of, like, the giving it his best,
the
kind
overlord.
Of evil Lion King twin kind of thing. And he has no answers. And then we, the little people, we look to government for answers, of course, and then they just kind of, you know, throw.
So, you know, I found these people that should have known better, who their jobs were, in fact, you know, they're supposed to be professional risk takers. And so anyone who's a professional risk taker is supposed to know when to hit the brake pedal. And these were people that, you know, had the train heading over a cliff and were still accelerating. And that, to me, is, you know, is a fascinating human condition. And hopefully the film kind of shows you in a very, very tight time frame, you know, why some of these people made the decisions.
When did
they
you
did.
Write the film? Is it based on any particular bank? I mean, we're all going to kind of go, well, it was.
Yeah, people have tried to say that it was Lehman Brothers. Mm-hmm. It sort of isn't in my mind. In my mind, this bank is still in business doing what they're doing. So it's but it was never supposed. It was supposed to be sort of, you know, very universal. It was a mashup.
But one could imagine, and this is because it's a universal drama, yeah, that this conversation, this scenario played out
all
across
over the place. Well,
I don't know how many banks there are in the world.
Yeah.
Too bloody many.
Yeah.
But it must have played out in boardrooms across the mall
it
on
did.
A certain night
and the,
like
and
this.
The neat thing that I loved about the way we sort of structured the film is it could have happened 3 or 4 years before the actual crisis, or it could have happened a week before the crisis, in that there were people sort of calling an end, you know, leading up to this. And so the film is really about a group of people when they see the quote unquote end, or what they think is the end.
I mentioned to you Paul Bettany, one of the stars you were attracted to the part, but I mentioned also Jeremy Irons, Demi Moore, Kevin Spacey, very good actors came to this. I imagine it was, and this is a compliment to you, because the script was really good and tight. And I mentioned David Mamet, and
yeah,
you know, they spit things backwards and forward. This is a fucking shit shower. That
yeah,
kind of, you know, they
it's
wanna...
an act. I mean, it's the only reason we got the movie made. You know, it was made for $3 million US.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? That's like that's chump change
no,
for these guys.
Exactly. No, no one got
not the actors.
The actors.
Yeah.
No one got paid.
Wouldn't bankers invest? Did you try and go?
We tried in the summer. We tried to make the film in the summer of 2009, and it was a little close to home to all the, you know, the American, the U.S. independent film business, you know, is basically propped up by the 1%, by people with a whole lot of money, frankly. It's the only people that can kind of afford to invest in films. So to go out and try and raise money from them in the summer of 2009 was not an easy task. But even with this cast, you know, we shot the film in 17 days, which is a, you know, very, very tight
intense
shooting schedule. Which
in a building in New York?
In one building. 80% of the film takes place on one floor, the 42nd floor of this skyscraper, which in the end, you know, the neat thing for us was what I kept trying to do as a filmmaker was use my weaknesses as strengths, as opposed to kind of denying that they were there. We ran towards them. So this is
you've learned a lesson from your own script.
Exactly.
About what the bankers did.
Exactly. And we, exactly. You don't run from it. You try and make something from it. And so we shot the film incredibly quickly, but there was a sort of underlying panic to obviously when you're trying to do something that quickly. And the neat thing is, I think that shows up in some of the performances. You have these classically trained, amazing, Oscar-winning, you know, actors who are being asked to perform these sort of very intense, long scenes under duress. And the neat thing is, in the edit, I started to kind of move towards some of the moments where you see Jeremy Irons sort of shudder a little bit. He's still this macho CEO, but hopefully what I tried to do is get at a couple of those little moments where Jeremy, the actor, was doing things that he wasn't comfortable
he's
with.
Gone for me. He Jeremy Irons kind of went to the camp and the kind of histrionic many years ago, and I
yeah,
kind of like it when he does it. He was really good in this.
No,
I mean, it was a long time since I've seen him be this.
Yeah, year. I mean, I've sort of love him personally as well. He's a wonderful guy creatively. And, you know, I think the performance he gives here, it's, you know, he has such that sort of, you know, size that he brings to a role, but he is also kind of showing a weakness here, which, you know, that character, this is the worst night of that character's professional life.
Yeah.
Even
but he's
though
kind
they
of
would,
cool under pressure.
Well, he has to be. That's what all these bankers sort of, that's the whole point, is never let him see you sweat. But hopefully his performance, you know, what I would love is that his performance communicates that, you know, underneath, you know, he's not too happy.
What about you? First time feature filmmaker having to deal. I mean, Spacey's obviously a very nurturing kind of guy,
yeah,
and Bettany is happy to work for a good script. You had some young people, but you had some big. You Demi Moore as well.
Yeah.
You know, these did it take some handling? Were they very helpful towards you? Did they just...
They were. I mean, they all showed up. Like we said, it's a $3 million film, so they all showed up for the right reason. You know, they weren't there for the money. They weren't there for no one knew where this film was going to end up. So that certainly was great that they all showed up for the right reason. But, you know, I'd been waiting a long time for this opportunity. I had worked in commercials and documentaries and industrials and, you know, whatever anybody else mm-hmm. would
you knew pay,
me,
set.
Pay me to do. So I knew that this script had attracted them. So I had confidence that this was the story I wanted to tell. And, you know, frankly, I kind of went into it. And the minute we were, you know, a day or two into this, I didn't care that it was Kevin Spacey mm-hmm. to a certain extent. I just felt like if he did what I knew he was capable of doing and I got this script, you know, on film that I believed in, that we'd be all right.
JC Chandor, thank you very much indeed for coming in. And thank you for your film Margin Call, which gets the new year off to a sprightly and kind of slightly depressing start.
But it's entertaining, no, right?
Definitely entertaining.
All right.
Absolutely.
Well, go see the film. Go see the film. I'm very excited to be here.
I love
Thanks
the fact
so
that
much.
You're sharing the podcast with a review of the Iron Lady, the Thatcher film, who made all this possible. We have her to thank, ultimately.
Well, that's a very – this film was 20 years in the making due to the deregulation.
And Margin Call is on general release here in the UK from Friday the 13th of January. That's all for this week. The music we've been featuring on the show is the handsome score to The Iron Lady, somewhat surprisingly by Thomas Newman, best known for his work on Wall-E and American Beauty, to tie in with Kevin Spacey a little earlier on there. For the best film news and reviews, pick up a copy of The Observer on Sunday. I'm in there this week interviewing Steve McQueen in fuller detail. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly as ever, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.